Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
What's good, internet? It is Monday, June 18th, and you are listening to Waypoint Radio, episode 164, and I am your very sick host, Austin Walker.
E3 gotcha!
E3 got me.
Oh,
so I didn't sick. Know. Austin is so sick.
I didn't know until I started talking today, because I hadn't spoken. I got brunch with a friend over the weekend, and that was fine. I didn't sound like this, I don't think.
Takes a couple days for those bugs to...
I got bugged up.
Yeah, you got a little bugged.
Those are the voices of Daniel Riendo.
Hello.
And Rob Zachney.
What's up?
Also joining us, Patrick Klefik.
I'm not sick, but I've got a kid, so give me time.
Yeah. Just give it a day. You'll give it a day there. Or two.
Today, we are going to try to hit some of the things from E3 that we didn't find time to talk about last week. There are a bunch of things on this list, so we're going to move kind of quickly, and then we're going to take a break. We're going to come back, and finally, we're going to get to hear Danielle talk about playing Prey Moon Crash, which I'm very excited to see based on some of the screenshots and streams that I looked at over the weekend. So let's dive right in. I have a list of things in front of us, and some of these we're going to blow right through, and some of these we're going to linger with maybe a little bit longer. I'm going to start with a couple things I can just knock off the list. I saw Tunic, which I think we talked about on a Periscope, but not in a podcast.
Cute Fox,
Zelda Fox. I don't have too much to say. I'm excited to see more of it. Has kind of a Dark Souls stamina combat system, has sort of Fez style, other puzzle weird things happening in the sidelines.
Cool.
Really cool enemy design. But also a very like soft feel to it. It's not Dark Souls-y in the sense that it feels punishing or it feels like depressing to be in, which is a feeling I like about the Dark Souls series. It's just like bright and colorful and very cool. And then I also played Desert Child, which is Disclosure, a game I backed on Kickstarter, which has like such a fucking cool aesthetic. It's kind of like you're a futuristic speed bike racer, like a pod, almost like a pod racer who shoots stuff and who also delivers pizzas on the side. And it's early, but I suspect the game is like mostly aesthetic. It is, for instance, you walk around the environment and as you explore like the town you're part of, which is bright and colorful and filled with people, it cuts to like very interesting weird angles. It's not just like a side scroller or like adventure game look. It sometimes will be like a close up on feet. Great.
Oh.
Like just like his sneakers walking, or it'll be a close up of like, or a weird angle looking down at the marketplace or whatever. So that's cool, but I don't think it's going to make the, I don't know. We'll see. We'll see what happens. Like I hope it finds a loop that really works for it. But right now it's like, its aesthetic and its music is so strong that I'm curious to see what happens with it. Those are the two short things I saw. I also saw – we didn't get a chance to talk about this – Tetris Effect, which is the latest game by – what's the name of the studio, Patrick?
I had it and then you asked me to say it and then it went away. I feel like it's one of those things if I just sat here long enough instead of looking it up.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Nope. Didn't happen. All right. No, I'll look it up.
It didn't happen.
It's just called Tetris Effect?
It's called the Tetris Effect or Tetris Effect.
Click, click, click. Oh, the sun. I'm sure they'll give me the information I desire.
I'm on Polygon. Enhanced Games.
Enhanced.
No, sorry.
There it is.
Enhanced Games. Yes.
You got it.
That's
you
it.
Got it.
That's Enhanced. It. There's not
I wanted
a second
to say
part.
Remake. Like I was too, like I was putting that word over and over my head because I knew it was close.
Yeah.
So Enhanced, yeah, sure. There you go.
Or wait, is it being developed by Resonaire?
What?
Tetris Effect.
Resonaire the company?
No.
By Enhanced Games.
Are you sure?
Yes,
this,
I am
this
sure.
This is what Chelsea wrote. I trust Chelsea.
Okay.
It is Enhanced Games. That is the outlet.
Okay. I believe you. We saw it. We saw it with PSVR. We saw some extra modes without the VR on. It is Mizuguchi. It is, what if the people who made Rez made a Tetris game? What if the people who made, Lumines made a Tetris game?
They did make Lumines.
They did.
Lumines Remastered.
It's those people. Oh, yeah, okay. Exactly. and so it is a really cool experience to play a good Tetris game in 2018 after years and years of terrible Tetris games coming out. I guess Puyo Puyo Tetris was actually really good, but.
But if you're talking about like a pure Tetris game, there really has not been one that has sort of hit the bar that Nintendo hit a number of years ago with Tetris DS. Like, there have been Tetris games that you can convince yourself is fine. And yes, there are like alternatives like Puyo Puyo Tetris, but Nintendo's is still sort of like the gold standard for Tetris games. And, you know, too early to say like where Tetris Effect falls in there, but it seems like it's going to be closer to a good Tetris game than like the trash that EA and Ubisoft have been putting out for years.
Yeah, so like the whole thing is that you're playing Tetris along. It's almost like an album game. It's a game that's like a lot of music, and each stage has its own song and its own visual kind of background stuff. So that can be kind of like a wild, like neon light explosion thing, or it can be kind of like a weird forested area, or it can be like, you know, 30 or 40 songs, it looks like.
Nice.
Maybe more than that. On like hard mode, you unlock more stuff. And it does this great thing where some of the things you do is while playing Tetris are quantized to the music. So there was a moment in the first level where I realized that I was making piano notes by rotating the pieces.
Mm.
And so I was just like freestyle, like piano soloing by turning the pieces over and over again in interesting ways. It's just like a very chill experience, which doesn't mean it isn't difficult because Tetris can get kind of hard. What do you think of that, Patrick? Because you also played it.
Yeah, I mean, I like Tetris, but I've probably played, like, just, like, generally speaking, like, played enough. You know, like, it's not like a game that I'm sitting around going, like, you know what I could use? Some more Tetris. Although, and we'll get into this podcast, as I mentioned in a series of stories during our demo, like, my mother would probably have the opposite opinion, given that she is a hardcore Tetris player that went down some almost dark rabbit holes with that game when I was a kid. Well, bring up those stories on another pod, maybe closer to Tetris Effect's release. It's interesting to have it contextualized in a different way. I really enjoyed like the aesthetic framing. I have always liked the musical selection of Mizuguchi, even if I've been sort of hit or miss on his games. Like I like Rez and more that I respect Rez, but it's not a game that does a lot for me. And Child of Eden like fell. Like I've had a similar sort of reaction to, but this fits within a framework that is a little more of what I'm into, because like I do like Tetris and I like the aesthetic stuff that Mizuguchi brings to his games, and so having like I found that to be like a very pleasant, enjoyable way to play Tetris. Like I'm curious to play it. Like I don't know if the VR did a whole lot for me, like not in a positive or negative way. It was more just like I would say probably the most what the VR does more than anything is sort of locks you into the world, right? So it's like in the same way that horror is benefited from VR because you can't sort of like see the world around you, Tetris also kind of like gets a similar benefit because it's going for sort of an all-encompassing aesthetic experience. But you know, would I rather enjoy it on like my big projector with like huge speakers everywhere? Like that might actually be like a more enjoyable way. I don't know. But it's not one that I think if you don't have a VR headset, you're going to go, you're not getting the full Tetris Effect experience. Like I think it's enjoyable and interesting, but I don't know that it's sort of like make or break on the thing that they're building.
Right. I will be happy to play that game in a chair without a headset on. That said, it isn't like a stand up in your room scale VR experience.
No.
So it would be fine to play sitting.
Yeah.
Also, like, I don't know.
Hearing
I'm excited
the
to play.
Title Tetris Effect, though, and hearing about like Patrick's mom's dark road, she traveled with Tetris. Like, I'm picturing like the TV movie version of this, right? Where it's like, Joyce, you're always waiting for that one like long, narrow piece. And we've got a long, narrow son who needs you right now.
Oh,
there is a lifetime version of my mom's obsession with Tetris. So absolutely, like there is a the, like this old, you know, video game thing doesn't work out, I'll just go finally pitch that movie to Lifetime.
Finally
the movie about a mother neglecting her children because of Tetris.
God. Oh, God. So beyond that, the only other thing that I saw that we didn't talk about was Hitman 2, which, to closure, I have a close friend who is working on that team as a contract writer. So I'm deeply compromised to some degree. But also I really enjoyed that demo. That demo took place at a racetrack in Miami. And it was my mission to kill one of the racers on the track. In the full mission, you'll also have to kill another person. And in the full mission, there will be a loop and a timer so that, like, the race is 25 minutes or something. It will be over after that. And the person in the car will then, like, get out and, like, start doing post-race stuff. And there will be this kind of countdown of, like, hey, do you want to infiltrate her crew and, like, plant a bomb, you know, on her inner wheel, or fuck with the gas mixture or whatever. Like, there are all sorts of ways to kill that target just through that stuff. There's also a whole other thing where I ended up planting the bomb and also climbing to the rooftop after stealing a sniper rifle. So I ended up trying to shoot her, hitting her so that she would flip, and then pulling the detonator on the explosion or on the bomb I planted for just maximum Hitman bullshit. But the most fun I had in that game was the same as the most fun I have in all Hitman games, or especially in the last Hitman, which is like finding the mascot costume so I could sneak into the backstage area, and then finding a waiter outfit to sneak into the VIP area. Classic Hitman stuff. The things that are – there's some like – newish stuff around the way that it presents some of the items to you without blocking the screen so that you know what's going on. I'm trying to think of I was in that demo, so I wasn't really taking notes on mechanics. But I will say, especially coming off of the Cyberpunk demo where we talked about how wild it was, how busy that was with people, the Hitman 2 demo had a very similar effect. A much more enclosed space, the kind of like festival environment of like a luxury race, where, like, you know, there's like cars parked and spinning in place for the attendees to look at, and kind of a party atmosphere. It reminded me a lot of the Hitman Blood Money, New Orleans level. If anybody remembers seeing the Mardi Gras level from, I think that was Blood Money.
Sort of. Yeah, I vaguely remember.
It's just like, at the time it was a 360 game that felt like, oh my God, there's so many people here. If you go back to it now, it's not as convincing, but this felt that way. It was just like, oh wow, there are, and you know, the devs told me like 1,000 NPCs in that one little level, basically. And you know, that's just about an effect. It's about like, oh wow, I'm moving through all these people. Things will go wild if a bomb goes off, or if I do get into a gunfight, there's a sense of chaos. It looks really great. It played really well. I'm excited to play more Hitman. Like, it's Hitman. I love Hitman. It's weird that they're calling it Hitman 2. It's weird that we're now back to this point of like reboots just getting sequel titles.
Yeah, it's pretty weird.
But I really enjoyed it, and I'm excited to see more of it. And that's everything else that I saw. Who else has stuff that they saw that we didn't talk about last week?
I have the quickest thing ever.
What do you have?
Literally the quickest thing.
Gotta go fast.
Because you gotta go fast. I played Team Sonic Racing.
Awesome.
It was really fun.
What did you – which team did you play?
I played as all three.
We only had two when I played. What were the teams available? Explain what this game is.
All right. So it is a racing game in the sort of Mario Kart and what was it? It wasn't Team Sonic Racing. It was Sonic and All-Stars Racing.
And then Sonic and All-Stars Racing
Transformed. Transformed. There you go. Yeah. Which were great. Those games are
fantastic. Genuinely.
Really, really fun. You know, sort of like really good mechanics and a lot of fun. Very colorful sort of racing games. So in this one, you are on a team. You're competing against – you have two teammates. Whoever you choose, if you're Sonic or Rouge the Bat or Knuckles or whoever, there's sort of three classes of character, very Mario Kart style, all-around kind of racer, which is Sonic and I think Knuckles, or I forget, whatever. Sonic and Shadow. That's who it is. Yeah. I'm sorry. I got to get all my Sonic characters
right.
But the like heavy character who goes the fastest but accelerate the slowest, and the sort of tricky racers who are best at doing tricks and pulling off really good drifts and stuff like that.
Tails or I think that was Rouge.
Tails and Rouge, yes. And then the heavy ones are Knuckles and
the robot.
E101.
E101.
Something. Economics 101.
Economics 101.
Exactly. Yeah, home economics. Just really fun.
What's the third team? Because I only saw two teams.
Oh, that's who was playable at this demo. I'm sure there was like – it was all like –
you were saying that there was a third team available.
Oh, no, no. You're always like playing against, I think, three other teams or two other teams. Yeah, I forget exactly. But it's not just how well you do, but also your teammates, how well they do. So you're racing against – obviously, in this demo, it was all AI. So it was me and two AI racers. And you're always – one of each class is always racing. So you got your light, your
– you can't be three Sonics out there.
Not three Sonics. No, you got to share. You got to get your Rouge the Bat and your Knuckles out there too.
Right.
It's really, really fun. It plays well, and there's a mechanic for sort of sharing your items. So if you see that somebody's lagging behind, you can give them your item.
Because if you win the race and your two partners are in like last and second to last place, you might not win the race. Like even though you came in first place, it's about the team's overall point score stuff.
Exactly.
Likewise, if you come in fifth.
It's the way cross country works, actually.
Right. Totally. Yeah, that's, which is cool. I think it's a neat thing to try.
It's a little twist.
At the very least. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. How did you like the handling and
loved
all
it.
That?
Yeah, it's really fun. I won all the races except for one.
Ooh.
There was one. I didn't win with Knuckles. I'm sorry, Knuckles.
Damn.
You know. I'm not a heavy racer. It's just not me.
You're light
not
or tricky.
Not my style. I'm tricky or I'm
all arounder.
Yeah, I got to go fast.
That game felt really good when I played it a couple weeks ago. It has like Sega, for whatever reason, their racing games, I like drifting in those so much more than other arcade racers.
It feels like a little heavier, weirdly, in the drift
itself.
It's like
itself. I'm fucking in this drift.
You're like, in the drift.
You like slam deliberate. Down. You're fucking in it. Yeah, exactly. I love those. I love the feel of those games. So that's this year,
I think so, yeah. Right? Believe so.
I'm sure someone knows.
I had their little website up somewhere.
Somewhere.
Oh, no, I changed it to find Team Enhance. I'm sorry.
December. Scheduled for December.
Cool. I'm excited.
Yeah. Cool.
That was it. That was good.
Awesome. Rob, Patrick, do y'all have anything else that we have not talked about that you saw last week?
I briefly mentioned Killer Queen Black, which is a game that's coming first to Switch. It was part of the Nintendo Direct. It's an arcade game that has been floating around just like sort of a handful of different locations in the United States. It's an expensive cabinet because it requires – it's like custom made. It's requires – I think it's controls for 8 players. It's hard to describe what that game is. It is easier to watch a video and really to play it. But basically like you play – sort of a bunch of different worker bees. There's a queen. You can win. It's sort of in a 2D pixel look. It's just a kind of looks in some ways like a fighting game stage in which it's just flat. You can't like go anywhere. It's just the screen in front of you is what you're working with. And you can win in a couple of different ways. Like you can kill the queen 3 times. You can collect enough I don't know what they call the resource, but there's a resource you can collect X number of times and bring it back to your hive. And then there's a snail at the bottom of the screen that moves extremely slow. And if you can ride that snail all the way to the other side, it's an automatic win. It's basically like a fun fake out way to kind of spit in the face of your opponents because you often you don't usually win that way. So that people tend to not look at people using the snail. So it's like a fun way to kind of win in an unorthodox way. But they when they announced that game or when they released it in the arcades, part of the reason it was an arcade only release was because they wanted to emphasize sort of like local play. You know, that was they wanted people in a room together. They wanted people yelling at each other. And it truly is the best way to experience that game as someone that has played the arcade version a bunch of times. Like it really does benefit from the energy that you just like intangibly and tangibly sort of get in a room with other people who are enjoying a competitive experience. That said, I think it will still be perfectly fine and fun, and I'm glad that more people get a chance to play this game. And so, my understanding is it's coming to Switch first and then, you know, PC and other places later. And so it is a really interesting version of that game. They've added a bunch of new mechanics and wrinkles. There are weapons and sort of other sort of types of bees that you can transform into that have different sort of specific attributes. So something to keep an eye out on. It sounds like we may actually get a chance to kind of show people what that game is sometime in the near future. So if my description of it is not specific enough, you will get a chance hopefully to kind of show you what that game is all about.
That game, like for people who maybe haven't seen it and you're listening to a podcast in a car or on a subway and you're underground and you don't know what the fuck we're talking about, it almost looks like – I kind of realized from like – I'm just staring at the screen. Like how do I even describe this? It's almost like a very big joust stage and each player is like hovering around and, you know, some of them can pick things up and move really quick or jump really quick and other ones have like – wings and swords, and you like it's a big couch multiplayer style like fight around these resources. It's really neat. It is a really cool game, and I'm excited that people will finally be able to play it. You know,
yeah. I don't know when they said when the release date is for that, but I believe it's sometime this year. Cool. Game I didn't get a chance to mention that definitely should have fit in last week, but we just had so much to talk about was Spider-Man.
Oh, right. Wow. Did we not even talk about Spider-Man?
No. Jesus. No, it just kind of slipped through the cracks because at some point you have to turn off the microphones and move on with your life.
You do.
I full disclosure, the creative director of the game, Brian Inahar, is someone that I have a long history work. He came from games media and has been in Insomniac for a number of years now, and this is his first, like, this is his baby. I have some crossover there, but this is the first chance I had to play it, and it's the one thing that I think people have wanted from a goddamn Spider-Man game since Spider-Man 2 is just nail, like, floating around, like, just swinging around.
Just
like,
swing around New York and make it feel good, please.
Right, that's not an easy task, right? That's not an easy thing to get right. Like, there's so much nuance in getting movement and fluidity right, and the way that Spider-Man works as a character is something very specific, and there's a reason that a lot of games don't put you in a big, wide-open space. They try to constrain you to combat and, you know, sort of swinging abilities that are within combat or small spaces, and, you know, this game goes for it in that way. It wants to let you have that, like, sort of quintessential Spider-Man experience, and I basically barely interacted with the way the demo was structured was like you have 30 minutes to kind of go around the space and you can explore side activities, you can go do combat, you can advance the story. And I, partially because I was having a conversation the entire time that I was playing and wasn't able to fully grasp the combat, other than just kind of like plucking away at the buttons and watching cool stuff occasionally happen, I mostly focused on the thing that means the most to me, which is like experiencing the swinging. And so I spent most of my time like running up buildings, jumping off buildings, swinging between buildings, and like I can confidently say that stuff feels extremely good. It is so satisfying. The way the swinging feels, but the way they let you connect moves to other moves so that you can in the way that we were talking, Danielle, about like Ori and the Blind Forest, like one of the things that is very specific and interesting about that game is its use of momentum, where they are always giving you tools to connect one thing to another so you don't have to touch the ground. A lot of that is based on the skill of the player and using a combination of tools that is like both observation and understanding how those tools fit together. Like there's this really neat move where you can identify sort of like points of interaction in the environment, and it's not just about like swinging, you know, left arm, right arm. It's like identifying those points in the environment and holding X so you can kind of like throw yourself off of it. And that stuff connects to running up walls, and it's just a real joy to control. And if they've gotten that part right, it gives me some measure of confidence that the other parts will come together, even if sort of the set piece stuff they have shown last year and this year, I think, is not necessarily what a lot of people were looking for. I mean, it's fine. Of course, you're going to see that stuff in a Spider-Man game, but I think there's a reason a lot of people responded to Sony's press conference as, oh, this like demo you're showing afterwards, right, which is actually how the game plays, is the more interesting bit. And that's the bits I spent time with, and that's the bits that I responded really positively to. So I'm really looking forward to playing more of that game in September, which is really not that far off.
Yeah, wow, that's soon. I definitely think that like that city looked really good. Like the one of the things that's interesting is there's not a night day cycle, but there is a time like situation where it goes between like sunrise and sunset. It never becomes night in that city, or at least not in the open world. I'm sure there will be night. We saw in the PS or in the Sony stage demo or whatever, that was a nighttime moment. So there will be night in that game, but it captures the sunrise and the sunset, like that golden hour, so well in New York. So I'm very excited to actually see that thing myself and actually play it. Anything else, Patrick, or is that it?
I think so. I saw Serious Sam 4. Didn't do anything to me. The pitch that for that game is like giant open spaces. They picked up on the joke about Fallout 76 having 4x the size of Fallout 4. I think their pitch was something like each individual level is going to be 20 times the size of Skyrim. is that what they were realistically promising? and that the, Wait, there will
realistically
be not just
promising.
Oh yeah, yeah. They're what? Using procedural generation okay. to like build the levels. That's been a, like a huge part of the tech they've been working on for the last couple of years. The game has vehicles. Like there's ways that you can like go through spaces extremely quickly. Mm. And also they need the enormous spaces because like they were. The end of the demo is where you really – like most of the demo is just fighting a handful of enemies and then the demo ends with coming across not hundreds, not thousands, but tens of thousands of enemies running at you. And so I guess that's the big sort of like, what is Serious Sam 4 about? It's about tens or hundreds of thousands of enemies coming at you at once, which sounds like it could be sort of an interesting gameplay wrinkle because that is that's sort of like the – that's what Serious Sam's pitch since the beginning was like, we're going to throw a ton of enemies on screen at once.
Right.
But it was – they didn't get to that part of the demo until the very end. So it's hard to tell like sort of how will that impact your ability to actually play the game. So it could be interesting, but it was mostly a visually flat Duke Nukem sounding shooter game, and Duke Nukem in the bad way
right.
Sounding shooter game where like the most interesting part was something they really weren't showing a whole lot of yet. I think the other ones I played, I feel like we're like, did I talk about Mega Man 11 on the Periscope? I don't know. Mega Man 11 looks really good. I'll just say that. I'm really excited to play more Mega Man 11. Resident Evil 2 looks really good. Yeah, I'm curious to see more of the changes to that. I talked to Sam Lake about Control, and that some version of that interview will either go on a podcast feed or I'll write up at some point. He's an interesting guy. I think that's it. I think that's it.
All right, that brings us to you, Rob Zachney. What did you leave on the show?
L.A. Rob.
L.A. Rob.
Reporting from not L.A.
I mean, I left it all on the floor. Really? Like, I was carried out of E3, basically borne aloft by the soldiers.
I carried him out.
Oh. Hey, you barely made your flight.
That is 100% true. Even early in the morning, LAX was totally hosed.
Oh.
Like, we got in that queue to, like, you know, that long road leading to the terminal is that giant U.
Yup.
We must have been in that for 20 minutes. And at a certain point, like basically at the bend, I was like, just let me out here. I need to make my flight, and bolted through the airport. And, you know, it's always good to just race onto your flight, just like covered in sweat and like short of breath and like sit down next to your seatmate and be like, sup, these clothes haven't been washed. I'm coming back to conference.
Time to do this for 6 hours.
Yeah. Or 10 if you were us.
Yeah, if you were us.
You just missed me so much.
You
wanted to give me and my wife the vague threat that maybe I would have like five people coming to my house.
Oh my god.
And a nice doggy for Pixel to be friends with.
That would have been so good. You know? Yeah.
My dog hates other dogs.
Oh good. So it would have been a real family moment.
Yeah. We also had like a bad trip to the bad is strong.
We left like a lot of time.
We left a lot.
So we were okay, but it took forever.
And our driver, our Lyft driver, was very nice, but also was extremely had a startup where she made copper labels, copper antibacterial labels to put on things.
Like your phone.
Because copper kills all germs.
I mean, she wasn't. I was sitting there and I was like, you're not completely wrong. They do put silver in certain types of clothing to make it antimicrobial.
Yes.
But it was one of those. It was a lot in the morning when we're just driving to the plane, our last day. We're all dead inside and outside.
I just wanted to just shut down so bad. And she just wanted to fucking talk to me about her copper.
Yeah.
But then she was like, fuck Trump a lot. And that was
– She was actually like a really awesome like middle-aged – like she's like a middle-aged white lady who like is like, yeah, I'm from the East Coast. Rob, she was from Massachusetts.
Yes.
She's from the North Shore. She had the accent. And like she just reminded me a lot of my mom.
I bet.
Like middle-aged white lady who's like, fuck you, Trump.
Yeah.
Fuck 100%. You. Like it was very endearing in a way. But
it was very good.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's the story we were telling. anyway, besides our trips to the airport, what else did you see, Rob?
So I was on the Warhammer beat.
Oh yeah, love it.
Yeah, and so I like my first appointment of E3. I just stumbled into Warhammer Chaos Bane.
Oh,
you guys ever played Diablo?
Yeah, no, what's that?
Yes.
Tell me what that is.
So it's what they call an ARPG. It's an action RPG where like where a lot of RPGs are about like story and like plot development. Action RPGs are about sort of hacking and I dare say slashing your way through dungeons.
I see.
And this is that, but in the Warhammer Fantasy world.
Hey, I have a question real quick. Why can I not find anything about this video game on the internet?
Is this real?
Oh, no. Has this happened again?
Oh, no.
I see it. Oh, Chaos Bane is one word. I see.
Was it? Wait, is one word?
It's one word.
That's not how it was styled on the booth. I'm pretty sure.
It's not. It's 100. I'm looking at the stylized. You're 100% right. It is stylized with a big old space in the middle, but... Tell me about
weird.
It's one of these. It's just one of these.
Yeah, it's fine. Like, I played it. It's, you know, if you want this but Warhammer, your ships come in. Like, there it is. It seems fine.
And to be clear, this is fantasy. Warhammer Fantasy, not Warhammer.
Right.
And the old Warhammer Fantasy, not the current Warhammer Fantasy?
That I do not have enough of a sense of how that universe has evolved.
Okay.
Like, I think there's three different directions they've gone with it now, like in its lifespan. This is just, you know, the same Warhammer Fantasy that you'll see like in Vermintide 2.
Gotcha.
That's how it feels.
Yes.
But, you know, by those lights, it still feels good. You know what I mean? Like it was enjoyable to play. When I do play these games, I bounce off a lot of them. This one, I probably would have played more of.
Okay.
It seems like it'd be a really fun co-op game in particular. Brought back a lot of those good Diablo 2 memories. Other game I played that was a little more interesting, and we're going to skip over Space Hulk because I just couldn't find time for that appointment, and the interface was a lot of buttons and a lot of icons in a way that I found very daunting and yet familiar. So I was like... It's day three of E3. I just can't parse this right now.
Fair.
So Necromunda Underhive Wars.
What?
That's an interesting one.
One more time?
Necromunda Underhive Wars.
Sure.
That's not real. That game's not real. You made this one up.
Necromunda.
No. Necromunda. Right.
Munda.
Munda.
Yeah, like...
World, I just
like
opposite Rhode Island it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ah, I see.
Underhive.
Like an under, wait a second, that's under twice.
So, well, yeah. So anyway, there's hive worlds in Warhammer 40K.
Right.
And
which is sci-fi Warhammer.
Yeah. And here there's like gangs of local toughs and youths engaging in street battles in the Underhive with chain swords and like cobbled together flamers and shit.
Okay.
I think it's by the Mordheim team. It looks considerably more polished than Mordheim, which, from what I've heard about Mordheim, is definitely a good thing. I don't know if Mordheim worked like this, so somebody can set me straight if I'm wrong on this. But
yeah,
this
group of people will definitely be able to tell you about Mordheim.
Well, I more mean the listeners.
Oh, okay.
Somebody out there.
Oh, I thought about it for 12 seconds, and now I know exactly what Mordheim is. Fuck. Fuck me. Why am I like this?
You
anyway,
know what Mordheim is?
Go
You're
ahead.
Very sick. You're very sick.
It
You're
is.
Very tired.
It's true. Go ahead.
So the weird thing about this one is it's actually got a really cool layout. Like, your big strategic map is the sprawling, like, 3D holo projection of this multi-level battlefield.
Huh.
So it feels like you're fighting inside old abandoned factories. It's all very like, you know, Blade Runner 2049, like out in the sprawl type shit that you're playing in. And they're really extensive levels. There's a ton of like vertical paths between layers of the levels. But the really interesting thing is, you sort of enter your squads of, it's all like 5-on-5 battles or 7-on-7 or 3v3, but you send your squads on the battlefield one at a time, and you control your characters in kind of this Valkyria Chronicles over-the-shoulder camera perspective.
That is how Mordheim worked, yeah.
But it is a turn-based game, and if you're playing against somebody, they're doing the same thing simultaneously while you're playing. And where the turn-based thing comes in is if your two active characters encounter each other, you enter phased battle, at which point both of you go through a very like thinly sliced up step-by-step battle as your characters sort of interact with each other at close range and like burn through their action points.
Huh.
Otherwise, you both play simultaneously, you both take your turns, and then once the last person has made their move, you go to the next round, you control a new character.
Okay.
And it seemed pretty nifty. It looked good. It seemed like a really cool, like, what if Valkyria Chronicles was like a competitive tactics game?
Right. That's an interesting pitch. I'm into it.
Yeah, and the multiplayer, you can do like one-off battles, but you can also sort of turn it into almost a like Blood Bowl-like team system where you'll develop your squad from mission to mission to mission. But if they totally get like destroyed in one multiplayer match, characters are actually dead. Loot is actually lost.
Huh. That's interesting. So a little more XCOM in that sense.
Yeah. So that was surprisingly cool. I suspect that like that's definitely going to be like a cult game for those who really get into it, but it seemed pretty cool. A game that I did not find so cool. I looked at the new Tropico.
Oh.
And
was Tropico number 6?
They're up to 6 now. Haimamont has departed the series. So Haimamont just made Surviving Mars.
Right.
But they made all the previous Tropico games. Now the license has stayed with Calypso. It's a new developer. And if you're not familiar with the Tropico series, it's what if it's a city builder, but in a like 60s, 70s, like Banana Republic in the Caribbean or Latin America.
With all of the racist caricatures,
yes,
and tropes,
oh,
to match.
Yeah, it's
especially
like it's a city builder, but everything is dysfunctional and backwards.
But also, like in Tropico 4 or 5, straight up leaned into weird caricature for like NPCs and talking heads who would like give you tips and stuff like that. It's gotten weird over the years. Like, it's always been a very particular pitch that has had like. It's always been a very fun city builder that has had some tonal stuff that's been like, ee. But the I want to say Tropico 5 really put me off with that stuff. Anyway, tell me what the new team's take on it is.
It's the same take.
Oh,
that's the.
Okay.
I mean, it's like all their new features are, you know, now it's not just one island, but it's like archipelagos. We've got more topographical variety, right? There's actual mountains and tunnels going through them and like, you know, these huge multi-level maps, which they looked great. It looked like a cool game. You know, all the individual citizens are now like individually modeled, so they don't just like Tropico. The previous Tropico games used very loose modeling of like citizen activities and pathing. This time it's going in a more sim direction, so
okay,
planning matters a little more. But here's the thing, this shit just isn't as funny as if it ever was. It sure isn't now. One of the things they showcased during this you know preview is and here you have the prison, and if you want to, you can click this button, and that's convict labor.
Oh,
and the problem is there's a lot of things wrong with it. One is that it's presented in this kind of almost Dungeon Keeper-esque, like it's good to be bad aspect. Where, you know, haven't you always, you know what I mean? Dungeon Keeper is always like, it's fun to like be bad and like fuck up the heroes and like kill the hobbits,
right,
which is a different thing than it's fun to be running the carceral state and creating slave labor in modern society.
Less fun, let's say.
Yeah. And the other thing is that, again, the Tropico series always worked in part by othering this idea of other places and cultures, right? This idea of the third world as being this sort of humorously dysfunctional and wacky place, where no matter what people try to do, it always ends up coming out a little bit twisted and wonky.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is the ways that the Tropico societies are like abusive and exploitative are pretty indistinguishable from the shit you're reading about now daily in the news around the world. And so it seems particularly like tone deaf and self-serving because it's like projecting a lot of the shit happening in like wealthy industrialized societies already as somehow a marker of, you know, haha, it's the Caribbean, it's Latin America, it's dictatorial and funny.
Mm-hmm.
And that just that doesn't fucking play anymore. And it seems really incredibly tone deaf. And I did not detect a whole lot of like self-awareness or critique coming from within the game. Well, right? And like, so it's not like
it's the sixth one. Like,
yeah,
you can, I can, I'm willing, do a couple of these, you know? And then you did the thing, like you did the bit. And if it was going to be critical within those first few bits, you had the opportunity to offer that criticism and to like, you know, to come at this from whether it's going to be a weird and wacky angle, which might not land, or a very serious angle, which also might not land. Like you had that opportunity. It's just frustrating to be like another one of these. Like we're it's such a limited. It's so limited in scope in terms of its focus. It doesn't make a case for itself.
Yeah, it just it feels like a series that really just make your tropical theme tourist paradise island city builder with a cool salsa soundtrack and just be done with it.
Yep.
Because like this entire motif is no longer working for you and is increasingly like there's like it's not satirizing anything distant in the past. It's just, you know, we live here now. We are all tropicans now.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else?
It occurs to me, I don't think we actually did talk about Greedfall. I think you and I talked about it in the concourse, Austin. I do not think we actually talked about it on the pod.
Okay. Do you want to hit that quick then? Because we're running, we're already running long on this one.
You know, then we should probably leave it. Because there's actually more to dig into than we can really touch on.
I mostly want to dig into that when it's out so that we can see if they stick the landing on some of the stuff that you were talking about.
Yeah.
Do you want to give the short version of like I know
give
you
me the two lines.
You have problems with the politics of this game, so explain to people at least what to be like, what they should be looking for as the you know if there's marketing about this game in the next you know the months to come.
Yeah, so the setup is it's an RPG set in a 17th century inspired world. It's got kind of a nifty setup in that you are explicitly like colonists coming to what they're like literally calling the new world, escaping what is becoming a charnel house in the old world. Like you are being afflicted by a almost extinction level plague that is wiping out your civilization. And in the new world, people are immune to it. And so it's all very like tricorn hats and gold braid and musketeers and shit like that, mixed with a bit of fantasy, quite a bit of fantasy actually with magic systems and everything. But you're part of this group that is like desperately trying to solve the problems of the old world by just by all the looks of it, just putting the new world to the torch and just like trying to loot it for answers and solutions along the way to getting rich as well, which could be a compelling setup. Again, my major issue with the politics of it is that it seems to be playing really fast and loose with the imagery and narratives of colonial invasion and violence. And it doesn't seem to have had much or any input or like thought put into like the indigenous perspective on stories like this.
Mm.
So that's my main reservation. Like stylistically, it should be up my alley. Like again, gold braid, lots of buttons. Like that's my shit. Like I'll, you know, I'm there. But it just seems a bit ham-handed in how it's approaching its themes.
Yeah.
Right. Totally. I'm super curious. I think that there was like an audience that really responded well to some of the character design and the kind of RPG stuff that they don't feel like they're getting elsewhere right now. And so very curious to see how that one sticks the landing. Anything else? I know we both saw Call of Cthulhu, which I don't know if we talked about, did we?
I don't think we did.
I'll check.
It was
the
like
thing.
Briefly mentioned.
Yeah, it's not listed in our discussed thing. Greedfall was apparently, but
some of the things that were like mentioned, I didn't write down because it was like, okay, this is like 30 seconds.
The big thing there is it's a detective game in which you're like going into reconstitution mode.
So there was one that we did talk about for sure, and it was talking to the fish people, and there was a lady whose mouth was sewn.
That's Sinking City.
Okay, that's Sinking City.
This
okay.
is Call of Cthulhu.
It's a different Cthulhu detective game.
Different Cthulhu detective game. One that doesn't feel as I guess it has some system stuff. You're a detective. You have skills. You use those skills to try to solve some mysteries. And that skill system seems weird because, like, it's a situation where, like, you'll have a search skill and you'll go into a room and it will roll – it will privately, quietly roll your search skill, and then you will be able to find clues in that room based on – like, the room will populate based on your search skill.
That's interesting.
With stuff, and you might just not get the right information. What was your takeaway from that presentation, Rob?
Yeah, I am super curious about how this comes out, but I could see it being either really cool or deeply frustrating on Satisfactory because of that exact thing. This idea of, oh, the clues might just not be there if you don't have the die roll go your way. Which also leads you to some, like, super detective stereotypes, right? Like, your character spots one thing and you, like, click on it, and then the detective spins an entire narrative out of one deeply ambiguous clue. But at the same time, like, it was pretty creepy, and I do love reconstructing crime scenes, so I'm probably still in for this.
Yeah, I am curious. So one thing that I'll say is they talked about how there is no way to avoid the insanity that comes with confronting the mythos, the dark truths of the cosmos.
Lovecraftian horror.
And I actually like the notion – if you're going to do this, I like the notion of taking it away from the eternal darkness model. We all talk about the eternal darkness thing of, like, you get more and more insane, and then it looks like your TV flickered off, or, like, everyone's –
your controller disconnected. Yes, yeah.
Right. And that stuff was, like, novel, and I think it was interesting at the time. It was a fun way to try to walk in that space.
Yeah.
But given the way of, like, playing with sanity and with mental health, and, like, I think that there's perfectly a way to tell stories about the kind of Lovecraftian cosmic horror that does break people's minds in that way. The confrontation of truth in such a way that it hurts you is a perfectly decent allegory for stuff, and a fairly powerful one when executed well. I like that they're like, no, like, we're saving those bits. We're going to tell you when that happens. This is not going to be like you saw a thing and that means your insanity meter goes up one. It's at points in the story, this character is going to have to confront things, and then we'll have to deal with the consequences. And I think there's something very strong about that approach that we haven't seen that often in these stories. I'm curious. We'll see how it goes. The mystery stuff is a little weird. I think we maybe talked about that, like, you could look around the room and be like, oh, there was a boy here because I saw some army men, and now I can imagine him in this room. It's, like, very much that style.
It's
like
a sad little detail. I did like that, though. Like, he built himself a little fort.
He did build himself, yeah.
His life, because he was kind of frightened of, like, what was going on with his family.
I'm just saying that's not –
those sorts of details are good.
Sherlock Holmes would not – he'd be like, that's not deductive at all. You're inducing a lot here. You're inferring a lot here.
What if it was a girl?
Who knows? Mm-hmm. Exactly. That's all I have on my list. You saw something called Rise of Industry?
Yeah, no, it's a supply chain and factory manager game. Like, it's Factorio, but in the 1920s in a lot of
okay.
ways. It seemed fun. It seemed cute. Like, I'd be more down to play that than Tropico.
Oh, that game is out in early access, in fact. So
yeah, and it's pretty far along in early access. So, cool. Like, mostly I got shown their roadmap from here, which is a lot of end game polishing stuff and feature expansion, but the core stuff is very much like get inputs, create new output, use output to power other factories and shit like that.
Sounds like
I'm kind of curious.
Those. Yeah.
Baby Tactics Gamer is a little bit curious about
this
sort of stuff.
City building? You're going to move into city building? We should send you some Anno games.
I might get into that.
All right, let's take a quick break and then come back and talk about games that were not at
E3. On the moon.
Well, one of them was on the moon. Prey Moon Crash was. So let's take a quick break and come back. I want to check in with Danielle and see how it is that we even have her back from the moon.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
All right, we are back. Danielle, tell me about the moon. Tell me about Prey Moon Crash, the DLC that was announced and released while we were in LA. You're smiling from ear to ear.
Hi, Austin. I'm calling you from the moon.
Hey, Danielle. How's it going on the moon?
It's awesome. Okay. All right. I'll stop.
Okay.
Is that oxygen? Are you slurping something?
It was oxygen, and I was
slurping ramen.
I thought it was
moon?
Tang.
I thought it was like.
Also, aren't you dying a lot on the moon?
You know, that's a consequence of being on the moon while it's crashing. You know, sometimes you die a lot, and it's all right. You know, I saw Hereditary this weekend. I understand how it
is. Lots of death.
But no, so Moon Crash was announced like a week ago.
Okay.
I think it was a week ago. It was Bethesda.
The Bethesda event.
Right?
Yeah.
Was that
yeah.
Monday?
Yeah, sure.
That was Monday.
It was all a lot.
Sunday.
So I think that, other folks played it right away. We were obviously at E3. I was like twiddling my fingers the whole time. Like, I want to play Prey. I was like, I'm looking at all these nice games and they're very nice, but I want to play Prey. And we talked about how it was sort of presented as almost like a roguelite sort of experience where you go in, you die a lot, and the simulation changes each time. That's sort of what they said. Okay, it takes place on the moon, the simulation changes each time. They
endlessly
didn't really go into that.
Endlessly replayable or something.
Endlessly
like that,
replayable.
They said, right?
Infinite toy box.
Right.
But what it is, I mean, that's not true. But what it is essentially a really huge story level, like a level from the game that happens to have some of these elements, but that sort of infinitely replayable portion of it refers to the fact that you are going to be five different characters. You unlock them as you go. If you complete one character's mission, then you can start unlocking the other characters.
Okay. So what do you mean by mission? And also tell me about what the space is
like.
Yeah,
of course. Here, let me just walk through. I've played 2 hours of this thus far. I was on my ambulance last night, so I didn't play more. But I played a bunch of it this weekend. And you start out, and you are a hacker. You're in space. You're looking at the moon. You're not on the moon. You're a hacker who is in this horrible contract, speaking about the sort of gig economy. They go hard into that in this. You're a hacker who's basically an indentured servant who is given this simulation. Obviously, a lot of Prey has to do with simulation and things that happen in your brain and chips and all that sort of stuff. And your job is to sort of figure out what happened on the moon based on all this data, because apparently you're so good at sifting through data.
Right, sure.
Whatever. It's like a nice little narrative conceit. But you get to go home to your family if you do a great job here. It's
cool.
One of those. You see
Love
portraits
it.
Of your kids and your wife and all this sort of stuff. So you go in the simulation and you start out as one character. He is one of these sort of Russian prisoners who was used in the experiments to make the neuromods.
Okay.
And he is really heavy in psi abilities, but pretty weak.
Sorry. Is the hacker character you're playing as on the moon, or is that just
on the
frame for now playing the psi ability?
Oh, sorry. The hacker is the sort of main character that you are playing as. And then the next level.
Then there's a next level
of
you're
the
going
simulation.
Into the simulation.
Exactly.
And are playing as Psy Russian guy.
Guy. Prisoner something.
Is he one of the prisoners?
He was one of the prisoners.
From the main game? Okay.
I don't think he was in the main game, but
okay,
it's like,
but
that's the idea. He's one of those folks.
Gotcha.
And in that second level of the simulation, you are playing as all these different people to piece together the whole story.
Gotcha.
That's kind of the idea. And the gameplay conceit is that each of these people all have different abilities and they have different loadouts. And as you go, you can sort of purchase more and more things to kind of go into the game with, basically.
Oh, interesting.
Which is very cool.
Okay, so it's like that way it is like a roguelike.
Very much so. But thankfully, I think for a lot of people who are worried about story content, there is a ton of story content. This does feel like a level from the game that they sort of added a lot of stuff into to add in sort of those roguelike elements and added in like a lot of these character elements. But it feels like it's as big as, maybe even bigger than a level in the game.
Right.
It actually has other areas you have to kind of load into. That's how massive it is. There's also a moon shark. I'll get to that later.
There is a moon shark,
and it's amazing.
That's
new enemies, new abilities, new weapons, new everything, along with the stuff that I think worked really well in the first
game. Do you think it's a situation where someone like me or Rob or Patrick, who are like, yeah, we want to play this, could get a lot of story out of it,
I think,
then be like, all right, we're done, where someone like you could get the – I want to keep playing around in this toy box experience.
Yes, I think so. I was surprised by how much story there was. Right away, there's another chapter of that Starbender, like shitty sci-fi novel that's, sort of in there. And you're getting the e-books and the audio logs and all that other kind of stuff. And each one of these people is a character who has sort of motivations and has sort of a reason for being there, along with their other abilities.
Goals, right? So
yeah.
what is like the Russian side guys'
get
goal?
Off. Get into an escape
everybody's
pod.
Everybody's goal is to get off, though?
Everybody else has side goals as well.
Okay.
As sort of a main goal. And you have other ways of escaping. So I've only played as two characters thus far. The Russian, you know, prisoner dude mm-hmm. is the first one. It's mm-hmm. sort of the easiest. And then I've unlocked the engineer lady who can go to further places because she has different abilities, gotcha. Right? She can get out via escape pod or a shuttle. That kind of thing.
Right.
And she has sort of side goals. And I think side goal – there are like little side goals that will change each time. Like, oh, do kill this thing with this weapon or gotcha. Do this special thing. And then there's also sort of story side goals of like rendezvous with this character and do X, Y, cool. or Z, which is very cool. So I'm having a wonderful time with it thus
far.
Are
the characters – sorry for grilling you. I'm just very curious about the abilities and stuff. So is this – so in the main game, mm-hmm. your character in the original Prey, you could go in any different direction. Are these five characters set up where it's like they have their own ability loadouts and that is it? So like the Russian Psy guy can't be an engineer. You can't just dump your points into something that isn't what his character is like.
So I believe there are sort of paths okay. that you have. So again, I've only unlocked two of the characters thus far, but there are several different ways he could go.
Okay.
Now it might cool. be that certain things are only unlockable for certain
right.
characters.
The engineer might not have psi powers at all.
Right. I think she does.
Okay.
But it's so there are skill trees for each one of these characters.
Okay.
So there are massive choices to be made. Basically, it's not, oh, this is it. And there's also you can purchase that you get points for everything you do in the simulation. Mm-hmm. And you can purchase like, hey, I want to go in with a glue gun. I want to go in with a pistol.
Gotcha.
I want to go in with this, that, or this. And you can do that for any character,
cool.
basically. So there is a ton of choice. And I didn't feel locked into any one given thing sort
right.
of ever going into it. I will say I took notes because, you know, I like to have notes
totally.
For these things. Especially when they're Prey related. I wanted to say that sort of the first time through with any given character, it feels great to explore the world and play very much the way I played Prey, which was the first time through, it's all about the story. It's all about exploring every nook and cranny. It's all about sort of seeing all those things. Like, for example, I went to the sort of crew quarters area in this moon base, which has like a cafeteria and a really amazing gym that has lunar gravity basketball. And there's a whole little
awesome.
Like side story about it through emails and things like the chalkboard outside the basketball court. That's like they had little teams and they all had like really cute names of like who's doing better on the basketball team
right.
and that sort of stuff. So that was really, really cool. That felt very much like the crew quarters area of Prey, which had so many little tiny stories. And that was so much fun to explore. And then after sort of the first time through reading everything, seeing everything, I got, you know, very excited about that. Then it's like time to play with your toys and see what your toys can do
right.
and really sort of kick around. So I'm having a lot of fun with it. I need to play a lot more because there's several other characters to unlock and to go through all their scenarios. But this feels like they understood what was awesome about Prey in both the story, architecture,
right.
level design sense that I think everybody appreciated. And then the stuff that I really, really liked, which was playing with your toys and,
right.
and having all these different tool sets to kind of play with and mess around with and enjoy.
Do you think you'll die?
Oh, I've already died a couple times.
Okay, but it's not permadeath then. It's not – you don't have to restart the run.
You have to – so my play session ended the other night because I was really fucking around and I got really excited about the music and I was just messing around and didn't pay much attention and I died and I did have to – the
so
next time I go
one,
in, I have
wait.
To start as the prisoner again and kind of go through and unlock
wait,
more.
Okay. Rob, you your question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So hold on. Died? Like, are there different fail states you can enter and, like, you can fuck up and then you can, like, mega fuck up?
Kind of. As I understand it, again, I haven't unlocked everybody yet, but as I understand it, you can eventually, if you survive with one character and then survive with the next character and they all escape, you can start sort of unlocking them within that play session of like, oh, no, they're still alive. They can make it out or
oh,
they can
weird.
Do something else,
huh.
basically. So there's a sort of like banking element of like, OK, you can fuck around with them, but not on your last sort of life or your last person
okay.
who's in the simulation still, which is kind of interesting. I feel like that was almost like a softening of the roguelite elements
right.
to some degree. In there.
Interesting.
But I do need to play more to be able to like fully.
And you can't now jump back in with the engineer, even though you already unlocked
I think if
the
you
engineer
die means. With the engineer, you can't jump back in
gotcha,
with the
but
engineer.
If you've beaten with the engineer, you could maybe come back in with the engineer and then unlock the next one.
That makes sense, but I haven't beaten it with the
okay.
engineer yet. So
I
couldn't
know.
I couldn't tell you that one definitively. But mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's awesome. I think people who liked Prey, even if it was just for the story stuff, would still have a good time.
Awesome. I'm gonna check it out. I'm gonna try to find time this week.
Yeah.
Awesome. Briefly, because I can talk about impressions, but I can't give any final thoughts of any type. I have been playing Mario Tennis Aces. It has been my partner with me on my E3 trip. It has been really interesting. I think that the core mechanics and feel of that game, it's the latest in the long line of Mario sports games and Mario tennis games specifically, it feels really good. It's been described elsewhere as having a sort of fighting game feel in terms of having a super meter that you can kind of cash in either to like slow down time and counterattack or to do super moves that has a chance of damaging your opponent's racket and eventually breaking your opponent's racket. And there's an adventure mode, which is sort of like an RPG mode. You do level up, your stats go up, you do have like fun little challenges like – You know, there are a bunch of dry bones have taken over this whatever, this train yard. Hit them with tennis balls back at them and they'll die and you kill 30 of them and you're done. Or like boss fights where like I fought a haunted mirror at one point that like would use these other mirrors that were floating around as portals to send my own tennis balls back at me. And that way like those little side challenges are really good at getting you – they're really good at forcing you to – learn the mechanics. I don't know that they teach you the mechanics that well. I very much had to go into, excuse me, into the help menu and be like, what's a topspin? How do I do a lob? And like, I know what a lob is, but I don't really know the difference between a topspin and a slice. And so it very much had to experiment and like reread their little one line description a bunch to internalize that stuff. And even in the very early segments, you can tell that there are some wild swings in difficulty. Like, you know, early on, there was a challenge mode that I just had to skip over. Like, I was like, knock down 30 of these things or whatever. That was like, I cannot do it in the time I'm being given, but I can march through the kind of mainline stuff. And I kind of wish that even in the early segments that there's like, you're not – so it has an RPG stuff where you're playing as Mario. You are on an island that has an ancient culture devoted to tennis. There is an ancient evil tennis racket has taken over the minds of Wario, Waluigi, and Luigi.
Oh.
And they are trying to get the power stones.
The triumvirate.
It's right true. They're trying to get the power stones, which are a thing in this game because why not? To, I don't know, release an ancient
Sonic
evil.
Is there.
It's Sonic is there. Yeah. So is Thanos. It's a lot. but you're going through these bouts, these matches, and if you're getting XP, and your XP just kind of increases a stat, it doesn't – you don't get a choice. You can't be like, my Mario is going to be speed focused. It's just like a random stat is given an upgrade at the end of, you know, each level. And that's like – I want more than that. I want the Mario RPG that feels like Golf Story, the Mario Tennis RPG that feels like Golf Story, where like I'm going around the world and I'm playing tennis with a bunch of different people. There's also in the tournaments mode,
they should just let that developer just make a licensed Nintendo sports game.
Yes, do that. It would be great. There's fun presentation stuff in the tournament mode where there's like toads who are doing commentary on like the bottom of the screen. I'm sure you could turn that off, but I love it. I love being like, well, he dove for it, but his forearm's all busted now or whatever. And none of that so far at least has been in the adventure mode. It's all just been like straightforward. And like, I just, there's something here. The basic game is so good, but I wish that some of the stuff on the side from what I've played so far, was a little bit better. I'll have more thoughts on that later this week for sure. I think that just about does it for us today. I don't think I have anything else. We should talk about waypoints. I'm going to leave the questions in the question bucket. We can come back to those maybe on Friday. It's already gone a little long today. So, Danielle, what is your waypoint for the week?
Hereditary.
Oh, good.
Might be taking, you know, somebody else's too. I'm sorry if I did, but,
it's good.
That movie was fucking great. Really scary. But in a wonderful way where it just broods and it broods and it builds up dread and builds up dread and builds up dread, in a way that feels so earned. And my God, it ends on a high note. I might be writing a little thing about it this week,
okay.
But yeah,
cool.
Very, very, very you good, like intense ending. Horror movie. I loved the ending. I think the ending was.
I think I liked
Chef's kiss.
I there are various points where I'm like, would have been better if it cut here or here. But I think I liked. We can talk off mic about our readings of the ending. But
for
I think
sure.
It was really interesting.
There is an aspect of it that I won't spoil anything or go too far into anything. But there is an aspect of it that was very much like probably the most impactful story of Edith Finch of What Remains of Edith Finch in that. It's really cool.
Interesting.
In the ending itself.
Okay. We'll have to talk because maybe I'm forgetting Edith Finch stories. That's, I'm probably forgetting an Edith Finch story. Rob, what is your waypoint for the week?
I don't really have too much because, like, I spent a lot, like, I watched a lot of trash TV and movies on planes. But the most interesting trash I enjoyed in a week that involved Kingsman: The Golden Circle and Boss Baby, etc. The most interesting
Boss Baby is all right for a kids movie. It's all okay. Right. The worst. There are worse things you can get locked into watching 45 times.
I have no doubt that is true. I guess I was hoping for a little more like inner office politics, a little more Mad Men than just pure.
Jesus Christ, Rob.
That's the Boss Baby I was promised.
It's called Boss Baby.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, the most interesting crap movie I watched was A Perfect Host, starring David Hyde Pierce, which is currently back on Netflix. And it's basically an answer to a question that I think has been on all our minds since the 90s. What would happen if Niles Crane held you hostage?
I don't know. What would happen?
You would be invited to a very elegant and profoundly fucking weird night of socializing at his elegant apartment, where he may or may not be planning to torture kill you at the end of the evening. So A Perfect Host is basically one of those, a petty criminal walks into the wrong goddamn house, and ends up in this, hostage situation with, Hyde Pierce's character, who is this guy who's planning a party. And it becomes very clear very quickly that there are going to be no guests. No one's coming to this party. Only this thief who stumbled in here by accident is going to be the guest. At the end of the night, he's probably going to be killed. But in the meantime, let's party and let's play games. This is not a movie I heartily endorse, but if you just want to see like David Hyde Pierce just like buzzsaw through just like scene after scene, just chew it all up, spit it out. This is him at probably like his least restrained I've ever seen him in a performance.
Huh. That's interesting. I'm curious about that.
Yeah. What's it called again?
A Perfect Host.
A Perfect Host.
God, that's such an ominous title. Patrick, how about you?
I don't have a whole lot, but like building off of what Danielle mentioned about Hereditary, if you saw that movie and maybe you're someone that doesn't watch a lot of horror films, but like found yourself responding to that, largely because it's a movie that the horror is sort of like the undercurrent when there's actually like more of an A story that is about like a woman and trauma and families. If you enjoyed that part of it, I would definitely recommend The Babadook from a number of years ago. Also a film about a woman going through trauma, and that, yes, there is a horror like element. It is core to the story, but that stuff dances with and is effective because of the time that is spent with characters and learning to know who they are and to empathize with them. And with the story, you know, Hereditary is about like trauma and loss. The Babadook is about trauma and like motherhood in a different way and how that manifests. And so, yeah, if you liked Hereditary, definitely check out Babadook. It's a also weirdly both films first time debuts for a director, which is they're both monumental achievements for folks coming out of the bat. I mean, you know, people work on short films and stuff like that, but like in terms of like a big your first feature, both Babadook and Hereditary share that, and that they are both remarkable in that regard.
What I wish in my heart of hearts I could use my waypoint today is that I watched the first season of Riverdale. But what my actual waypoint is today is a piece in Texas Monthly called What's Really Happening When Asylum-Seeking Families Are Separated. It's written by Katie Vine. It's an interview with a woman named Ann Chandler, who is part of the Children's Border Project, and is an interview about what is happening on the borders regarding a separation of children from their families. From new arrivals. I'll just read this one tiny snippet from it again. The title is What's Really Happening When Asylum Seeking Families Are Separated. And again, it's at texasmonthly.com. Anne says, there is no one process. Judging from the mothers and fathers I've spoken to and those my staff has spoken to, there are several different processes. Sometimes they will tell the parent, we're taking your child away. And when the parent asks, when will we get them back? They say, we can't tell you that. Sometimes the officers will say, because you're going to be prosecuted or because you're not welcome in the country or because we're separating them, without giving a clear justification. In other cases, we see no communication that the parent knows their child is to be taken away. Instead, the officers say, I'm going to take your child to get bathed. That's one we see again and again. Your child needs to come with me for a bath. The child goes off, and in a half hour, 20 minutes, the parent inquires, where is my 5-year-old? Where is my 7-year-old? This is a long bath. And they say, you won't be seeing your child again.
Jesus.
Sometimes mothers, I was talking to one mother and she said, don't take my child away. And the child started screaming and vomiting and crying hysterically. And she asked the officers, can I at least have 5 minutes to console her? And they said, no. In another case, the father said, can I comfort my child? Can I hold him for a few minutes? The officer said, you must let them go. And if you don't let them go, I will write you up for an altercation, which will mean that you are the one who had an additional charge charged against you. So threats. It is a devastating interview. It is part of an ongoing collection of really strong reporting about this crisis at the border that has a set of complicated causes, but could be solved. It is not. Mm-hmm. This is not turning lead into gold. This is something that politicians in Washington could fix today.
It's getting funding to let families sit together while the process works out.
Yep.
That's it.
I mean, that doesn't solve immigration, but that solves this problem.
Yes.
And of course, separating children from parents over bullshit is not something that's new in this country, nor is it in a wider sense. But this specific practice is something new and horrendous. And so go read this article, What's Really Happening When Asylum-Seeking Families Are Separated. And shout outs to the journalists who are in the front lines doing their best to bring light to this stuff across the board. On that really uplifting note, I think that's going to do it for us this week. As always, you can send questions to gaming@vice.com. Shout outs to Bowen for letting us use the track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. Find out more about that at waypoint.zone/BOEN. You follow me on Twitter at Austin_Walker. Where can people find you, Danielle?
At Danielle RI.
Rob?
At Rob Zachney.
Patrick?
We should at least mention.
I have one. That's not the way I wanted to do it.
You can follow me at Patrick.
I figured that was at the end.
Sorry.
Yes. You can follow everything that we do at Waypoint at twitter.com/waypoint. And at this moment, I wanted to say shout outs to Danica for the last 2 years of running that incredible account and being our forefront, our face forward person in all of our social stuff. Danica has been an incredible social editor. She has been a key part of our team. She's going on to a really, really fantastic opportunity. We are going to do a stream today. So by the time you've heard this, we've already done the stream, but go check out the archive of us playing some Jackbox games and hanging out one more time as she departs. Again, there would not be a Waypoint without Danica. She was like the second person here. It was me and Joel, and then it was Danica, and then it was Patrick, and then it was and Mike was here, obviously. But yeah. In terms of people I brought on, people who built that core team, and then Danielle, you joined, and then Rob and Natalie. But like Danica was so early and was so a key part of figuring out our identity and figuring out our voice and figuring out what our community should look like. So shout outs to her and shout outs to the incredible community team and the mod team there who are obviously going through a period of transition to figure out what next steps are for all that stuff. None of that's going anywhere, but you know, just shout outs to the mods for putting in the work over this next like transitional period too. That is going to do it for us now today. Again, go watch that stream. I'm sure we had a good time. I hope we had a good time. I might still have a voice. Until then, until next week, or until later this week for another episode. Danielle, what do we say?
Be good and be good at it.
Peace.
Danica's leaving big shoes.
I hate this. I hate you so much. Who could possibly fill them? I don't know. Peace.